Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Commodity Futures Trading Commission says it's looking into speculation in the oil markets. You might want to look in the mirror next time you get a chance, because you and your pension fund might just fit that description. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us today. It is the 30th of May, a Friday. I know, you don't like to think of yourself as a speculator. Nobody does. But here's the thing. All the money that's gone plowing into oil over the past year, all the billions of dollars that have driven prices up to where they are, it had to come from somewhere, right? You could round up the usual suspects, hedge funds and the like, but buying oil doesn't always mean actually buying the commodity itself. There is an easier way, with something called a commodity index fund, which is where you come in. Because there is a school of thought out there that says investors in those indexes, like your pension fund, are part of the reason oil is so high, and they could get hit hard when, or maybe if, oil falls. Peter Butel is with the energy consulting firm Cameron Hanover. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on in the oil markets, obviously. There's supply, there's demand, there's the Federal Reserve. I mean, there's a bunch of things. One of the sources of money, though, one of the investment vehicles, are these commodity index funds. What are they, and who typically gets into them?
Well, the whole classification of commodity index funds at this point includes not only the Goldman Sachs index, which tries to track oil, but it also includes municipal groups, unions, pension funds, college foundations. Basically, they're large amounts of money that have typically invested in the past in stocks and bonds and real estate.
Do these commodity index funds work the way most commodity investors do?
No, they don't, because most commodity speculators actually buy and sell in equal measure, and a lot of times we'll sell things before we have it. We'll sell something we don't have and then buy it back at a lower price later. These index funds, or large groups of commodity funds, are now just buying and they're not selling. So the issue today is whether people who have not traded commodities before and who have suddenly gotten a great love going for all commodities, whether or not they should be involved in this trading.
What's not to love, though, with prices going up the way they've been?
Well, the big problem is commodities move very, very quickly with very high leverage, and they may think that they're devoting 5 or 10% of a portfolio to commodities, but if the markets start going against them, they could easily lose a lot more than they put down.
The pension guys will tell you, though, listen, we're experienced investors. It's not like we started yesterday, and obviously we don't want to hurt our clients. What do you mean speculators? Come on.
Well, I don't think that they are speculators, and the people who trade in commodities are speculators. My great fear here is that all of a sudden, some of these people that have come into commodities, say, in the last year or two, may suddenly find that they want to get out, and it could be very much like a lunchtime crowd trying to get through a revolving door where everybody's standing in a long line and can't get out.
And what eventually happens to prices then?
Prices then collapse, and in oil markets, we have seen prices collapse in truly biblical ways when Desert Shield became Desert Storm.
In 1991, the first Gulf War.
Right, January 15th, 1991. The price in the afternoon was $32.75. When we went in that evening, it went up over $35, very close to $36. The next morning, prices dropped to $18. So you could very easily see oil prices drop $50 in a day.
How realistic, though, do you think that is?
I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. I fully expect that we're going to see maybe not a $50 decline in oil prices, but I certainly think there's a very good chance that we'll see a $25 decline one day. And that could lead to losses that would be much bigger than some of these investment classes are ready to take.
Peter Beutel is the president of Cameron Hanover. That's an energy risk management firm in New Canaan, Connecticut. Peter, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Billionaire Kirk Kerkorian has investing problems. Most of the rest of us don't. Earlier this month, he offered to buy 20 million shares of Ford. Risky business, given the way things are going in that business. But he didn't get to be so rich by being foolish, right? He said he'd pull the offer if Ford shares fell 10% or more. As of today, Ford's down around 18%, but Kerkorian says he's still in. So we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to try to figure out what he's really thinking.
As an investor, Kirk Kerkorian's known for saying what he thinks, but today he wouldn't comment on the offer. So I asked David Healy, an auto industry analyst, what's going through Mr. Kerkorian's head?
Kerkorian is thinking about making money. You know, it's as simple as that.
Healy says Kerkorian believes Ford's stock is undervalued. Kerkorian's investment company, Tresinda, already owns a lot of shares in Ford. If the tender offer goes through, he'll end up owning about 5.5%. Kerkorian thinks that stake will be worth a lot more if the company manages to get its act together.
Probably Kerkorian is right that a patient investor will make money in Ford when the economy turns around.
But right now, the situation looks pretty bleak. Last week, Ford told investors that it might not be able to reach its goal of profitability in 2009. Meanwhile, gas prices keep going up, and American consumers have responded by buying fewer trucks and SUVs, the bread and butter of Ford's business. Another Detroit watcher, Eric Merkel, says Kerkorian may be onto something, though.
What we have in the market right now is a bit of a commodities bubble, if you will.
He thinks gas prices have to come down, or at least plateau, soon. And Ford's getting ready to give the market what it wants.
You've got to take a look at not their product as it exists today, but you have to look at what their product is going to look like 12 months from now.
Ford's as tight-lipped as Kerkorian. It's not saying what it thinks of Tresinda's offer. As for Kerkorian, he's promising to keep his mouth shut and let the company keep on trucking. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
You want to buy a house someday? Finance a car? Great. Good for you. Hope you have good credit, though. While you might think you do, chances are you don't know exactly how good or bad your credit score really is. But knowing is going to get a little bit easier thanks to one of the biggest class action lawsuits ever. 160 million Americans will be able to monitor one credit score free of charge. Our New York Bureau Chief Joel Barshay explains.
The higher my credit score, the better chance I have of saving a lot of money.
Do you know your credit score?
Up to now, credit reporting agencies charged you $10 or more a month for that information. Now TransUnion will let anyone who's taken out a credit card or a loan since 1987 monitor his credit score for 6 months at no charge. But the figure consumers will get from TransUnion isn't the same as a FICO score. That's the gauge of credit that lenders use. If you want the FICO score, you'll have to pay extra. Ken McEldowney is the executive director of Consumer Action, an advocacy group. He says TransUnion sold Americans' private credit information. He says the real value of the settlement is to deter other companies from doing the same.
And I think that one of the things it's going to do is this should do a wake-up call for not just credit reporting agencies, but also for other corporations who may have been taking privacy concerns a little too lightly.
TransUnion will tell users when their score goes up and down. Liz Pulliam-Weston writes about personal finance. She says consumers could learn a lot about their credit if they subscribe.
If you, for example, go out, put your whole vacation on your credit card, max out your card, you're going to watch your score plummet. And that's a good thing for people to know because your score is very sensitive to how much of your credit you're using.
Pulliam-Weston says most people don't need to monitor their credit monthly unless they've been a victim of identity theft. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Crude rose today. Traders didn't panic for a change. We'll have the details and the week that was on Wall Street when we do the numbers. In South Africa today, politicians promised to do what they can to help the tens of thousands of migrants affected by the violence of the past month. Dozens have been killed. As many as 80,000 immigrants have been forced from their homes, most of them in the poorest of townships. Marketplace's Gretchen Wilson reports now from one of them outside Johannesburg.
All of South Africa's tensions pulse in Alexandra. Poverty, unemployment, and crime. 2 weeks ago, this township packed with 500,000 people convulsed violently. 58-year-old Elliot Sabanda is a house painter from Zimbabwe. He's lived here 37 years, but on that night, it made no difference.
I heard the mob saying, they want people from Zimbabwe. That's what made me run out of my house, run for my life. It was chaotic.
A wave of opportunistic criminality swept the country. South African taxi owners seized land owned by Mozambicans. Somalis were dragged out of their shops. Zimbabweans saw young men kidnap their wives and children. Looters went wild.
Everyone was screaming and crying. It was gunshots and knocking and bashing in windows.
Many of Alexandra's immigrants came here to the local police station. Now its parking lot looks like a refugee camp. White plastic tents shelter some from the winter rain. Hundreds of men stand in line for some bread and hot tea. A quarter of South African adults are unemployed, and some of them see these poor migrants as competition for jobs and businesses. Before the attacks, many of these immigrants had owned Alexandra's most successful convenience stores.
These are all small businesses. They are not insured, so all of that's gone.
Venetia Govender is a political and legal analyst in Johannesburg.
They're not going to secure another loan, or they're not going to be able to restart a business, so they've added to the unemployment numbers again.
But it's not just the migrants who will suffer. South Africans, too, will now have to travel further to get basic goods and services once provided by these migrants. Lauren Landau is director of the Forced Migration Studies Program at the University of the Witwatersrand.
And I think what you're going to see is that the price of food, the price of transport, and the price of a variety of other services is likely to go up.
Images of mob violence make foreign investors skittish. They also threaten South Africa's $1 billion a year tourism industry, its biggest generator of foreign exchange. The economic aftershock will be felt acutely outside of South Africa's borders, too. Immigrants in South Africa send about $800 million in remittances to their home countries every year. Zimbabwe's tattered economy is kept afloat by these remittances.
And if Zimbabweans living in South Africa cannot send money back, effort to rebuild that country is going to really suffer. And that is going to have economic implications for the whole region.
Now South Africa's neighbors are struggling to reabsorb the unexpected flood of returning citizens. More than 26,000 Mozambicans have gone home since the violence began, stretching local services to the limit. Some can't go back. 36-year-old Adelaide Congolo is from Mozambique. She and her children now sleep on the floor of the Alexandra police station, where people are starting to get sick from the unsanitary conditions.
I need South Africa's government to help me find a place to stay, because everything I have is here. My three children are South African. I don't have a life in Mozambique anymore.
So she is stuck with no good option. Her shack was taken over by squatters, so going home is unthinkable. And she's not prepared to face what lies behind the walls of this police station. In Alexandra, South Africa.
Just because we don't have anything better to do at this particular point in the show, why don't we swing down Dallas Way, talk to David Johnson, trying to scratch out another
like
living.
That.
How are you?
I like that. You know, and here I am sitting around humiliated anyway.
I know.
And you just, you heap it. So you want to ask me why I'm dressed like this?
Sure, go ahead.
So I'm all dressed up and no place to go. I thought there was this big party going on.
Yeah, well, there is. They just didn't invite you.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I really thought that along about now we would be kicking into high gear and we would see money just flying. It's sitting on the sideline. I think it's building up there. It's big. It looks like buffalo, you know, in the winter with just these big heaps on the sides of the road that
and
have
yet,
built up. Yeah, nobody's spending any money. I mean, we could even get these two drunks to prop each other up, United Airlines and U.S. Air.
No, I know.
Nobody will do it. And then I thought, well, we're going to see a lot of deals coming from overseas. You know, we've seen a few, but not very many. And the clock is ticking. They want to get any deal you're going to do, they want to get done while this administration's sitting there because they think they're going to have a better chance of doing it.
All right. Well, loath though I am to do this, I'm going to throw last week back at you. You said, you know, people are going to start being in a mood to buy and really get it going here, and now not.
Well, now wait a minute.
All right.
We bought individual stocks. I mean,
yes,
the Dow was
That's
up 1.25%.
But nobody's buying each other, right?
Well, not yet. Right. I really thought it would happen. I really thought it would happen.
What gives?
Well, I think Wednesday was really sobering, and I think we're still digesting this. Today was a nothing day. Mm-hmm. We had very light volume. We just sort of drifted. I mean, they couldn't even rally oil or kill it, either one. But you go back to Wednesday, and Wednesday was the day, was that inflation day.
Mm-hmm.
Remind
everybody.
Well, we had Dow Chemical come out and say they're going to raise the prices on 3,000 products by as much as 20%. We'd already seen Kimberly-Clark say they were going to hike up the price of, you know, diapers and Kleenexes and everything they make. Then Ford cut salaried workers by 10 to 12%. Yep. You got to figure that's tied to energy, tied to inflation. Deutsche Post, you know, owns DHL.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty well packed in the United States, said we're going to team up with UPS. That's got to be energy, I guess. JetBlue, the most successful of the, you know, the brand new startups after Southwest, deferred delivery of 21 new airplanes. American Airlines cutting capacity.
So the thread here that I'm hearing actually is energy and oil, right?
Yeah, it is. I don't know that it's all about oil, but right now it might as well be. And that's what Wall Street really cares about more than anything. So today, you know, oil was $127.35. It's down $8 from the highs. It's not enough. And that may well be the resolution. If in the back of your mind you think it's going to 150 or 200, maybe you don't do anything. Maybe I take off this stupid tux and
maybe you do that because the party's not going to happen.
Get back to work.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Take it easy. Coming up, comedy with a little product pitch on the side.
I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials were basically flat today, lost less than a tenth of 1%, 7 points to close at 12,638. The NASDAQ added 0.5%, 14 points, down to 2522. The S&P 500 gained 0.1%. 2 points closed at 1,400 even. For the week, the Dow was up 1.2%. The NASDAQ advanced 3.2%. The S&P 500 gained 1.7%. And just for the record, a rally in tech stocks helped push the NASDAQ up more than 4.5% since the month of May began. Investors hung up retail stocks after J.Crew lowered its earnings forecast late yesterday. Shares in the apparel maker tore off 20%. Macy's joined the parade. Get it? Macy's parade, dropping more than 1.5%. I love that Macy's parade. Chemical giant Ashland burned off 8% after J.P. Morgan downgraded its rating on the company. The news was not all bad, though. Dell gave technology shares a boost. The computer maker uploaded a 5.75% gain today. You are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for April. A portion of the chain-link fence wrapped around the Woodstock concert site goes on display. It's just one of the exhibits at the new museum at Bethel Woods, telling the story of the 60s and Woodstock. And it's time to catch the big one. Kids get a fishing lesson in D.C. at the kickoff of National Fishing and Boating Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The National Center for Education Studies figures something like 1.5 million brand new college graduates are going to be set loose on the U.S. economy this year. So, what to tell a 22-year-old humanities major about to go looking for her first job? Commentator Megan Husted says there is no shortage of career advice out there. It's just that most of it's useless.
It took me about 6 years after college graduation to realize that almost every lesson I'd absorbed about the workplace was wrong. My mother, of course, had always told me to just be my own sweet self. Monster.com encouraged me to dress with confidence. Both disastrous ideas. And how about this bullet point? Stay alert for opportunities that allow you to showcase your best skills. I've been working for over a decade, and I'm still not quite sure what that means. How is a 22-year-old supposed to know what her best skills are, never mind the optimal moment to unleash them on the world? After all that pressure to get into school and land a career track job, you'd think we'd spend more time making sure that those entering the job market were armed with wisdom they could actually use. The problem, I think, is that today's advice for graduates tries to be too motivational. But as I discovered over the last year of combing through a century's worth of career counsel, we used to do better. Take Andrew Carnegie. He once recommended that young office clerks acquaint themselves with a janitor's closet so they wouldn't feel themselves above the grunt work that accompanies entry-level jobs. Writing in the 1960s, Helen Gurley Brown was also specific. If no one notices you in meetings, she said, bring a red leather notebook to the conference table and start taking notes with a vengeance. Then there's Mark McCormack, author of a 1980s business bestseller. He advised paying attention to unguarded moments and the expressions on your colleagues' faces. I don't know about you, but I think that's all a lot more interesting than look for opportunities to showcase your best skills. Fact is, most entry-level employees don't need brainless platitudes to get them through the day. They need technique. They need a working philosophy. Entry-level jobs can be humbling, sure, but those cubicles also provide space in which to practice the art of living. And for such a grand undertaking, you need more than just bullet points.
Megan Husted's new book is called How to Be Useful. If you've got career advice for recent grads, useful or otherwise, drop us a line and tell us about it. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. I had hoped to get through the program today without having to mention the big movie that's out today, the sex one, but apparently that's not to be. Sex in the City opens today nationwide. Nobody who knows the television show from whence it came is going to be surprised to see the stars carrying brand-name handbags and gushing about brand-name shoes. That's half of what the show is all about. But working products into plot lines comes with a challenge: how to do it without turning off the audience and the regulators. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Last spring, Philip Rosenthal testified before a House subcommittee on behalf of Hollywood writers and actors. Rosenthal created the sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. At the hearing, he played a clip from the TV show Seventh Heaven. Various characters extol the virtues of Oreo cookies. At one point, a young man proposes to his girlfriend.
I love you, Rose.
The engagement ring is buried in Oreo filling.
Will you marry me on our wedding day?
I will.
That's a beautiful story, yes. Maybe if the writers and actors weren't so worried about covering that engagement ring in creamy filling, they could have taken a look at the line, will you marry me on our wedding day? Right? Surely a nominee for most terrible anything.
Rosenthal isn't just worried about bad writing. He says stealth advertising like this forces writers and actors to essentially endorse commercial products. And he says it exploits the emotional connection viewers have with TV shows, often without their knowledge. The Writers Guild of America wants the FCC to consider requiring some form of disclosure. The commission is looking at various options. One idea, each time a product pops up in a script, text would appear on the screen telling viewers they're watching a paid placement.
That would make the irritation that some people already have over this stuff tenfold.
Robert Thompson teaches television and popular culture at Syracuse University. He says viewers are a pretty savvy bunch.
If you are watching commercial television, you have just made a pact with the people who are delivering it that you are entering heavily commercialized space, space that is dominated by the needs of commerce, even over the needs of the art that's apparently getting you to go there in the first place. I think most viewers are fully aware that this is going on, and it's led to, occasionally, some really delightful outcomes.
Take this episode of the NBC comedy 30 Rock. Tina Fey fawns over a Verizon wireless phone.
I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one?
She faces the camera.
Can we have our money now?
Syracuse's Robert Thompson says 30 Rock is echoing TV's beginnings. Jack Benny and Sid Caesar plugged their sponsors' products with a wink at the camera. And if the wink isn't disclosure enough, Frank Zaza has a less intrusive suggestion. Zaza helped broker one of the most famous product placements of all time, the starring role of Reese's Pieces in the movie E.T.
I would want end credits. Why not have my credits up there to show that I thought enough of this program to embed my product in it organically and seamlessly? And if you have any questions, call us.
Zaza sees good product integration as a welcome alternative to the clutter of spot advertising. Wouldn't you put up with a few more subliminal messages if you never had to see another car commercial? As networks struggle to hold on to advertisers in the TiVo age, you may not have a choice except to turn the TV off. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to send you into the weekend. Who says the government's rebate checks aren't going to do any good? The Commerce Department reported its April figures for consumer spending and income this morning, both nudged up around 0.2%, a figure analysts are attributing mostly to those stimulus checks, even though they didn't really arrive in bank accounts until May. Before you get ahead of yourself, though, there is this. One study we saw today said if oil stays near where it is, that'll eat up almost $90 billion of the $110 billion the rebates are going to come to. And that is Marketplace on this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 7 points. We'll call that pretty much flat. The Nasdaq bumped up 14 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points. That is also pretty much flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, in Kenya's slums, the entrepreneurial spirit still thrives.
This is our coach. It is a sofa. It is called a skeleton sofa, and we are selling it $120,000.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.